Here it is. As long as you are my brother, you will never let this happen again. Do you understand? I don't think you do.
What if I can't? I'm not built like you, Nard. I ain't never been like you.
It's all right. Jack, it is not the violence that sets man apart. All right, it is the distance that he is prepared to go. Jack, look at me. We are survivors. We control the fear. And without the fear, we are all as good as dead.
Hello, and welcome to The Collision, Collider's podcast about movies, TV, and more. I'm the site's managing editor, Matt Goldberg, and with me are associate editors Adam Chitwood.
Hello.
And Dave Trumbore.
Hello, everybody.
We are all back together this week. Adam was away 2 weeks ago, and Dave was off last week, but the gang is back together, and we are here to talk about summer 2012. It is over, and perhaps we should be thankful for that. We will also be talking about Lawless, which is a fairly strong way to finish out the summer, and we will finish up with our recommendations. So with that, let's get right to it. Summer 2012, what I would deem not a success. A lot of potential, a lot of films to look forward to, and yet just a constant stream of disappointment. It started off so strong, and I think with the Avengers, it's not even a matter of like, oh, they set the bar so high. Yeah, it was a high bar, but look at what we had. Look at what we were so excited for, and rightly so. Prometheus.
Mm-hmm.
I think Amazing Spider-Man had potential, and then The Dark Knight Rises. My word. And let's just whatever we do, let's just not rip on The Dark Knight Rises.
I think we have about an hour and a half.
I think we like ragged on that for like two or 3 hours of just like boo, Bane was stupid. But I don't know. Was I the only one who was pretty disappointed in this summer?
Yeah, I mean, I'm going back over our most anticipated for the summer, and we were pretty jazzed about a lot of the movies coming out over the last 3-4 months or so. And a lot of them are pretty forgettable. I'm having a tough time really going back and picking out the ones that kind of stood out. I mean, the superhero movies, starting with the Avengers, I still think Spider-Man was decent. And Dark Knight Rises, I enjoyed as an end of the trilogy, but really nothing really stood out to me this summer. There's nothing that I saw that was really like made my summer or made me want to go back and see it 2-3 times. I really think that the strongest part of this year is going to be the quarter that's coming up now.
There's always next quarter.
I'm hoping anyway.
There's always next quarter to turn things around. I thought we had a really strong spring. There were a lot of films in the spring. There were films in the spring that were surprisingly good, like Chronicle.
Mm-hmm.
And then films like I Love the Gray. I can't stop quoting 21 Jump Street, even though it came out back in March. Cabin in the Woods was phenomenal. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't like 2012, what a wasteland. It's just we hit this summer. And we're talking about the blockbusters here. I think there's a lot of good independent films that came out this summer, like Beasts of the Southern Wild, Robot and Frank, Compliance. There's good stuff at the art house. But when it comes to the heavily hyped films, we did not have what I would deem a great summer. Adam, what do you think?
Well, for me, it wasn't so much that the summer was a disappointment. It was that the movies that I was looking forward to were not the ones that I ended up loving. It was quite the opposite. I was pretty underwhelmed by Spider-Man. I wanted to love Brave, but I only kind of liked it. I'm kind of in the minority that I didn't love Ted. It didn't really blow me away. But I think Magic Mike was excellent.
Yeah, I would qualify that, though, as more of an independent film. Maybe it's in The Verge. It's like a mid-range film.
Well, I'm just saying that like on my radar of like anticipated films, Magic Mike was not on there. I wasn't looking.
I see.
I was excited for a new Soderbergh, and you could put Moonrise Kingdom on there. I was excited for a new Wes Anderson movie, but that didn't blow me away. I know we're talking more about blockbusters, but like in my mind, this summer wasn't a terrible summer. It's just that the big movies, like you said, are not the ones that were great. Paranorman is maybe the only movie that lived up to my expectations of the whole summer that I was really, really looking forward to and I really, really loved.
Yeah, I would say Avengers and Paranorman were sort of the ones that really delivered. And it's just, it was that the films we were looking forward to, did we have unfair expectations?
Well, I mean, the campaign looked really great. I still haven't caught the campaign.
It's fine.
I haven't heard great things about it. Dark Shadows looked like a return to the goofy Tim Burton of, Beetlejuice, and it was definitely not. I don't think Bourne Legacy was a waste, but it wasn't mind-blowing or anything.
Kims! Oh, I'm sorry. Go on.
Kims? Same with Prometheus. I didn't hate Prometheus, but I was hoping that would kind of be mind-blowing, I think, as was everyone else, and it would end up on like a top 10 list at the end of the year. Snow White and the Huntsman looked fantastic, but that bored me to tears.
Yeah, I think that was the problem. It was disappointment because a lot of the stuff had been kind of built up, maybe just in our minds, maybe because we're so saturated with all the marketing that's involved with a lot of these things. But I think also the pedigree that came before a lot of these properties too. I mean, you're talking about Brave as a Pixar property, and we talked about this at length before, but you're always expecting Pixar to kind of go to that next level, give you what you expect and more, and kind of supersede your expectations. And Brave was okay, but it didn't quite meet my expectations, and it definitely didn't exceed them. I can say the same thing about Prometheus. I was really expecting more of a visceral but also intelligent sci-fi thriller, and we got kind of the opposite of that. I mean, it was visceral in a sense, definitely not as intelligent as I had hoped. So I think it's kind of that disappointment. Maybe we built stuff up in our own minds. I definitely did for a couple of these properties. There were a few surprises scattered throughout. I'll agree with Adam that Paranorman is probably my standout as far as what I had expected to see. It met my expectations and did a little bit more. So that's probably what I'm going to take away from this last quarter as my most enjoyable theatrical experience, I think.
When we look at summer, for me, the summer is, this is why we come to the theater. Like, right. I'm looking forward to the final quarter of the year. I'm looking forward to September, October, November, December. There's so much to see. I cannot wait to go to TIFF later this week and just start tearing it up. I'm seeing like 4 movies a day, and it still won't get to everything I want to see. There's so much good-looking stuff.
Goldberg. Can't
Boo.
See it. He wants to see it, Tiff.
Yeah. Poor me. No, I'm trying to make the point that there's a lot of good stuff out there, and you guys agree with that. There's a lot of good-looking stuff. And already, good word is pouring in from Venice and Telluride on certain films. So there's reason to be excited. This summer, there were highlights to look forward to, but there was also stuff that I was never really looking forward to. Battleship or Men in Black 3. Stuff like that was just not interesting.
It's forgettable.
Every summer has that.
Sure.
But going back to my point about we go to the movies in summer because that's the big screen experience. We want to be wowed in a way that we can't be wowed at home. Art house movies are moving to video on demand before they hit theaters, which I think has its benefits. I think more art house films or art houses are disappearing, and while that really, really sucks, I want, at the very least, for people to see these movies. And so if the only way they can see it is video on demand, well, at least they'll see an independent film that deserves their attention. But we should be wowed by the big screen, and not just in terms of spectacle, but big ideas. We want the films that kind of have it all, and movie theaters want films that have it all, and studios want films that have it all. And yet at the same time, we're getting, I mean, it's all product, but if this is the best we can do for product, what does the future hold ahead? And I honestly wish I had the numbers right now to see if summer 2012, how that compared to last summer in terms of box office revenue.
Right.
And I'm just trying to look at last year's box office to compare right now. And again, we weren't getting amazing stuff. We really weren't. I mean, last year it was like The Hangover Part 2, Pirates 4, And what else did we have? We had Transformers 3.
Yeah, it's all sequel properties.
Super 8, and I didn't like Super 1 through 7. So Green Lantern, that sucked. And, you know, it feels like, well, I guess this is the mixed bag we had. Because, I mean, there was also good stuff in the summer. There was Harry Potter. There was Captain America. There was, you know, Thor was pretty good. I mean, it's not amazing. X-Men First Class was great. And so it's just
the running theme here is remake, sequel, reboot. Nothing feels risky. Everything feels needed to death. Like Spider-Man feels neutered. I mean, even Brave felt a little. I mean, there was obviously strife behind the scenes on that movie, but everything just feels really streamlined. We're not seeing anything that we haven't seen before. Even though this year isn't as heavy on sequels, but everything, it still feels like a sequel to something else we've already seen.
Let me ask you guys this. What's your favorite summer movie, just going back through like your lifetime of movie watching experiences? What's your favorite all-time summer movie?
Well, that's
on the spot.
On the spot.
That's
for,
right.
Holy shit. Let me
this is live.
I'm looking at Box Office Mojo right now, so that should help me out with sort of
I mean, I can talk about mine. Like, the one that still stands out in my mind is Independence Day. Like, when Will Smith was still...
I was going to say that. That's a big spectacle movie.
I would go with...
Still the king of the box office for 4th of July. He was for, like, what, 4 or 5 years running?
Yeah, I would go with... And just because it holds a special place in my heart, I would go with Jurassic Park.
Yeah, great.
Because Jurassic Park was... I remember my mom, like, I don't know if she was reading the book. He's like, I don't know if he should see this. A dinosaur eats a baby's face off. And that doesn't happen in the movie. But it was, like, PG-13, and I was only, I think, I was, like, 9 at the time. But, like, my dad took me, and, like, the line was really long. And that's my first memory of going to a blockbuster movie. And I think, you know, kids today still have that experience. They still line up for stuff. Jurassic Park is an adaptation. So,
right.
You know, I mean, to its credit, Independence Day is an original idea. So it has that going for it.
But
I mean,
it was spectacle. Came out, the box office climate was not filled with movies like that.
Yeah.
That was something different.
It was something where Will Smith punched aliens in the face and was
it's not a movie classic, and it's not, you know, like, it's not going to go.
No, but I absolutely get it. I mean, for sure, that is a summer film. I mean, that's the July 4th weekend in the title and in its heart. And it's just like, feed me money. And it was a brilliant marketing campaign. You're right. It is sort of what we'd really like. I'm looking through the past winters. Do you know what the highest grossing film was in 1998?
98?
Yeah.
No clue.
Saving Private Ryan.
Okay. All right.
That is amazing to me that it's a war film.
Yeah, it's not your typical. It's not Independence Day. It's rated R. Yeah.
Well, that was a movie that everyone went to see. You took your dad, you took your families, and you saw it more than once.
You took your 4-year-old child, and you're like, this is what war looks like, Timmy, and he's like scarred for life. So, yeah, I mean, and I'm looking back through sort of. Obviously, it's just like the sequels take over. You know, I can go back to... Let's go back to 1980. And, okay, Empire Strikes Back sequel.
Sure.
And I'm listing off the top grossing films for these years, and we know which ones were the summer films and which weren't. Raiders of the Lost Ark was original. E.T., original. Return of the Jedi, sequel. Beverly Hills Cop, original. Back to the Future, original. Top Gun, original. I know someone in the comments is, again, or anyone who listens to it, there's going to be some guys like, no, Three Men and a Baby. Actually, Three Men and a Baby is a remake of a French film. Mm-hmm. But you thought I'd miss that one, didn't you, fuckers? So angry.
Goldberg on the attack.
Rain Man, presumably original. Batman adaptation, Home Alone original, Terminator 2 sequel, Aladdin, I don't know, original, let's say original, I mean, based off Arabian Nights, Jurassic Park adaptation, Forrest Gump adaptation, Toy Story original, Independence Day original, Titanic original, Saving Private Ryan, Titanic's not original?
I'm just laughing at Titanic as original. I don't know. I just think that's funny.
It is. I mean, it is.
Wait, yeah. What happens in the end? Don't ruin the ending for me.
Don't ruin the ending. It's not based off a book or anything.
Yeah.
Phantom Menace, prequel, Grinch, adaptate. Now, like, here's 1999, and this is where shit starts to change.
Mm-hmm.
And that's Phantom Menace, prequel, Grinch, adaptation. Harry Potter, adaptation. Spider-Man, adaptation. Return of the King, adaptation slash sequel. Shrek 2, sequel. Revenge of the Sith, prequel. Dead Man's Chest, sequel. Spider-Man 3, sequel. Dark Knight, sequel. Avatar, original. Toy Story 3, sequel. Harry Potter, Deathly Hallows Part 2, sequel. Avengers, crossover. mega sequel. That's it. There is a tipping point here. And so it used to be that you could do pretty well off an original premise, but obviously, in terms of the all-time box office, domestic, Avatar still holds the crown, but Titanic is there. That's an original. Star Wars, original. E.T., original. And so 4 out of 10.
But see, we've talked about this, I think, at length, too, is that studios know that rather than risk all their millions on an original idea may tank or not, it's just they know that they've got a built-in audience. They know they've got a built-in box office. And a summer is a great time to just
fill theaters with that. And it's not like again, Adam and I sort of talked about this last week, and okay. I kind of want to steer the conversation away from originals versus remakes.
Sure.
But at the same time, it's just this summer. I find it so frustrating in terms of if these films aren't good and if they're not blowing up the box office because ticket prices aren't going down,
mm-hmm.
what's left? I mean, can Hollywood ever change its game? And I would argue no. It's on the simple basis of, to quote William Goldman, nobody knows anything. If they knew for certain what would be a hit, they'd always make hits. And they don't. So, can I be disappointed in this summer? Was there ever a superior summer? I think the only one we're looking at is 1982. I mean, the Alamo Drafthouse had a whole series about the films that came out that, and it gets credit because it was so phenomenal. So I don't want to go back to this, you know, falsely remembered summer, but I think the stakes feel higher in 2012 because of distribution is changing. People are going elsewhere for their entertainment. Ticket prices are so much higher. And there arguably are fewer event films. And maybe they're never, I mean, that's another thing. What makes an event film? Are people camping out in lines like they were? It's tough to say. I mean, we have more theaters than ever before. And yet the box office every week, you know, we're talking about it doesn't not every week. But films can still struggle, you know? It underperforms. What's overperforming? We cited Ted and Magic Mike as the summer's biggest films that overperformed. Two films that it's not that no one was looking forward to them, it's just they're not The Dark Knight Rises. They're not The Amazing Spider-Man.
Sure, they're nice little like surprise films, and I'm glad that there's still room for things like that. I just kind of wish that there was a bit more. And maybe summer's not the time to expect that kind of thing anymore. You know, maybe summer is the time for your sequels, and you know you're going to get your franchise properties that are going to come in, and you can kind of expect that every year. And yeah, you'll get your spectacles, and you'll get a surprise every once in a while, but I'm kind of okay with that in a weird way. I'm kind of okay with summer being the time for just kind of like these popcorn flicks that they don't stick with you too long. It'd be nice to be surprised every once in a while. But I'm okay with waiting, you know, like I said, again, this last quarter of the year, hopefully that's where all my hopes now reside. So I'm hoping we get a lot more surprise there. And I'm okay with just being kind of moderately entertained for my dollars in the summertime.
This is one of those times I really wish the show had a call-in line. I would love to just start, let's have calls. How do you feel about this summer? Did you want to see a lot of movies this summer? Were you amped for Snow White and the Huntsman? Things like that, because Snow White and the Huntsman is spectacle.
And they had great marketing, too. It just, you know, fell apart. But
it did. And Prometheus, great spectacle.
Yeah,
if
great
that's
pedigree.
What we're going for. I think The Amazing Spider-Man, one of my things I really like about it is I think Mark Webb did a good job shooting the action scenes. So there's that.
Surprisingly, too.
But, I mean, in terms of spectacle, keep in mind, video games are really competitive in that market, although video games, it's like in reverse. All the big spectacle video games get held until Christmas time. So your Modern Warfares and your Pac-Man and your Q-Bert, those spectacle games. Actually, yeah. Speaking of those, I'm really looking forward to Wreck-It Ralph.
So am I, man. I hope it doesn't disappoint. I'm looking forward to that one.
I think that film might surprise some people in terms of just – I think it could end up doing pretty well in terms of gaming culture. But, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, people have more places to go than they did in the 1980s.
Sure.
To be entertained. I mean, you can pick up a box set of your favorite TV series. You can stream your favorite TV series. You can stream any movie. I mean, and that's the thing. What about these films says I have to be there opening weekend? Because that's what the economy is based off now.
Yeah. Or just in a theater itself. I mean, yes, the opening weekend is huge, but then, you know, putting butts in the seats week after week after week, you know, Avengers is still in theaters. It's coming back out, in theaters for Labor Day weekend this weekend. And it opened in what, May? April? May?
May. But that's the exception. Most films don't have legs. A lot of films are geared to get people in opening weekend.
Sure.
And if you can't get them opening weekend...
Well, I was going to say, to be fair, the Avengers has not done very well this weekend. I think the whole point of it was to get it above Titanic's box office.
Yeah, that's not going to happen. And I mean, that may have happened. And to be fair, I mean, this summer finished out pretty weak. I mean, there was no love for Oogie Loves. $207 per theater average.
That's rough.
Well, looking back,
that's almost Zizek's Road numbers.
Looking back at the common thread of what we were looking forward to and what we weren't, it kind of feels like all of us, and I don't know if this is indicative of what other people feel like, but like Matt, you said, we weren't really excited for Men in Black 3 because we knew what to expect. We were really excited for Prometheus and Snow White and the Huntsman because those are things that when we saw the trailers and you read about it, you really don't know what it's going to be. You don't know what to expect in it. And that comes with, I mean, the movies that didn't do that great this year look like, you know, sequels and reboots where, you know, you see the trailer for Lynn Wiseman's Total Recall and you know exactly what you're going to get.
Mm-hmm.
And looking again to next summer, it doesn't look much different. I mean, we have Iron Man 3, Star Trek 2, Fast and Furious 6, Hangover 3. We get In Night Shyamalama Ding Dongs after Earth. I'm excited to see. I don't know if that's Shaden Fraud or I don't know. I'm kind of eager to see what he's going to do with that. But
you're the one.
One is terrible.
$10 box office. Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, for me, it's like there's more room for. I mean, I think there's room to be surprised. I think there used to be like a lot more pleasant surprise. Not a lot more, but places where, oh wow, I didn't. That movie wasn't really on my radar, and it kind of came out of nowhere and really.
But that's what the fall and winter has become, and that's why we're so looking forward to that, because there's so many movies coming out that Django Unchained, like, we had no idea what to expect from that, but it looks amazing.
Sure, but that's a matter of expecting the unexpected. And even then, we're like, oh, well, it's Quentin Tarantino doing spaghetti western. Yeah. I'm talking about a film like,
Hope Springs. I was expecting a really, you know, like
Hope Springs.
Like
what a nice surprise.
That was a great movie.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say it's great, but I mean, in terms of if I told you it's like, hey, here's a movie about two old people trying to fuck, you probably wouldn't be like, oh, wow, can I be there? Is there a midnight screening happening?
We're going to line up.
I got to see that. But no, it is a good movie. It is entertaining. I mean, let me go back to 2009, and I would say there were pleasant surprises in the mix. The Hangover. Was that on really anyone's radar?
Right.
The Blind Side. From the trailers, I thought that would rot me in my soul. That looked like the worst fucking film ever made. And it was a nice surprise. It was not bad. I mean, G.I. Joe, The Rise of Cobra. Again, where that looked ridiculously terrible. Kind of entertaining. I liked the first G.I. Joe. Taken. Where'd that come from?
Yeah.
Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs. District 9. 2009, I think, was a pretty great year for films.
Yeah.
And it shows that we can be surprised. And sure, there were disappointments. Public Enemies was a disappointment.
Mm-hmm.
Watchmen, that wowed me out the gate, and I've never had any desire to revisit it.
Mm-hmm.
I think Avatar is a disappointment, but I guess I'm in the minority on that one. I mean, I was disappointed by Transformers 2 because I liked the first one. That was a pleasant surprise, the first one. But again, it's a mixed bag, and yet there were things that I think, in terms of, again, the pleasant surprises, we can have them. We can have nice things. But it feels like this year was a lot of disappointment.
See, I think we're just literally finishing the sort of unofficial end of the summer, too. And I think as just a bit of a caveat for this, we're still kind of in the thick of it. And with all these other years, we're talking about, you know, 30 years ago in 82, how it was one of the best summers ever. Or even just a few years ago in 2009. It's easier to look at it once you're removed because the things that stick out.
Right, absolutely.
Know, those are the films that stick out. So I think, yes, for right now, we can kind of say, like, okay, what stuck out in our brains? Maybe there's only a handful of films, two or three, that really are going to stand the test of time. And that's unfortunate. But, yeah, the future of things to come, we're going to see more sequels, we're going to see more prequels and franchise movies. But I still, like you said, I think there's still room to be surprised in the summer with spectacle on different levels, whether we see it coming or not. And I think once you kind of like get a few months past it or into the next summer and you're like, oh man, I remember that movie we saw last year. So hopefully we'll get to have that discussion next year when we're doing the same thing as a recap.
I'd like to, if we're doing this podcast next year, and
we
will be, let's look back. Let's try to look back at summer 2012 before we head into summer.
Revisit Battleship.
Yes. Well, I'm telling you though, I mean, going into summer 20, I'm looking at the film set for summer 2013, and I am not encouraged.
Yeah.
I'm really not. Like, Iron Man 3, okay. I like Shane Black.
Mm-hmm.
The Star Trek 2, I just get a feeling. I get a feeling that the first one was kind of like lightning in a bottle, and I'm very nervous about the sequel, especially when you won't tell me something as asinine as the name of the villain. Hangover Part 3, that one kind of has to earn it back.
Yeah.
A lot of people are looking forward to Man of Steel. I'm not one of them. Monsters University, we're going to keep hoping that Pixar brings back its spark.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of these films, I mean, we're hearing troubles. We're hearing troubles about them. We heard troubles about World War Z. We got that on the way. We've heard troubles about Lone Ranger. We've heard troubles about RoboCop. And it's stuff like that. And
Grown-Ups 2, the Smurfs 2.
Oh, thank goodness. Hey, well, at least Kick-Ass 2. Hey, at least there's Kick-Ass 2. I never thought Kick-Ass 2 would get made. That's more of a film like, oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
That's nice that that's happening. And no, there is still good stuff to look forward to. If nothing else, there's Pacific Rim in the mix.
True.
So I guess that's like the big film to get excited for.
I think the key is that now we're talking about going into next summer already, and we're already kind of just like, not really looking forward to it. And I think that's key because we came into this year like, oh man, there's so much potential. But next year
we will be prepared to be disappointed, and everything will be a win. Mortal Instruments will change our lives.
Oh man,
Phineas and Ferb, you won't even believe. Although not to rag, I mean, I don't know. Is that one of those? Is that like an Adventure Time show where it's like it's for kids technically? But
I mean, it just really is. I don't know if it's on the level of Adventure Time.
I mean, you know what I'm talking about. Like,
it has its fans. I think it has its adult fans.
It has adult fans, so it's not just like
from what I've gathered.
But I don't know. It's one of those things where I'm more looking forward to spring 2013. I am still interested.
March is stacked.
March is crazy. It's like that's when
Hunger Games. The Hunger Games did it. Now everyone's putting. It looks like March is the new
March is the new May.
Yeah.
Elysium, Oz the Great and Powerful, Now You See Me, Jack the Giant Killer, and G.I. Joe. Someone's gonna move.
Stoker. Park Chan-wook.
It is, but that is, you know, I mean, we're talking blockbusters.
I wasn't aware that we were talking specifically
blockbuster. We're talking blockbuster. No, that's what I'm saying. March is May, and like that's the
big movies.
The big movies are coming out there, and then April kind of slows down a bit. I mean, you have Oblivion in there, but then it's more like, you know, Jackie Robinson biopic and Evil Dead and Scary Movie 5, and then, you know, summer begins again. But you're right; it's like everyone's trying to capitalize on it, and sure, you have a little more blockbusters, like A Good Day to Die Hard is in February.
Mm-hmm.
okay. So yeah, it's going to be interesting. Again, I would like to revisit this podcast before summer 2013, not just in terms of listening to it. So not just revisiting what we thought of the films of summer 2012, but sort of going ahead. Because I think Dave's right. I think there's perspective that needs to come into play, and we're very close to summer 2012. It's just coming out of it, snap reaction, pretty disappointed.
This is how I felt last year, though, too. I was so tired. I didn't even love Captain America out of the gate because I was so tired of superhero movies and just spectacle and explosions.
Yeah, that was 2011 was stacked with. I mean, that was there were
not good ones like Green Lantern.
Green Lantern. Shit, can't even. I mean, wow. Well, I mean, Thor was good, and Captain America. I liked Captain America a lot. So there was Green Lantern, and clearly the fourth one really left an impression. There were. Oh no, X-Men First Class. I really liked X-Men First Class. Right. Shit,
I loved X-Men First Class.
Yeah. So there you go. Who knows? So I mean, let's look back at 2011 right now. Harry Potter, really, you know, really good.
Cowboys and Aliens, best movie of the year.
Best movie of the year.
Still haven't seen that one.
You still haven't seen it?
Nope.
Guess what? You don't need to.
Yeah, not too worried about it.
You know, Horrible Bosses, I really liked. Rango, well, that was in March, but Rango was terrific. I don't know. It's tough to say. It really is. I'm almost exhausted. Let's talk about something different. Unless you guys want to keep going. I kind of want to get into Lawless, because Lawless is different. Lawless is a film where the Weinstein Company wasn't really sure if they had kind of a potential awards flick or just kind of a rousing action movie. And I think they chose wisely. I don't think this film would have made it in award season. I think it would have been completely ignored. So I've written my review. My review's on the site, and actually, all three of us. Wait, Dave, were you with us?
No, I was holed up in the hotel room when you guys went to see it, but I did see it this morning. So,
yeah, sure. So, Dave, why don't you start off? Because Adam, did you see it again, or did you?
No, I haven't seen it since July.
Okay, Dave, why don't you recap the plot and let us know what you thought?
Sure. So Lawless is from director John Hillcoat, which you guys probably know from The Road. It was actually based off of a true-to-life novel by Matt Bondurant, talking about sort of his ancestors, his family members. It's set around the Bondurant family, which is Bondurant family, who is set in 1930s, so Depression era, Franklin County, Virginia, which is known as the wettest county in the world. And it's known as that because everybody that lives there pretty much produces moonshine, and they sell it illegally during Prohibition. Now, the folks in town who are the moonshiners, they get along with the local law enforcement because the law enforcement, A, wants the alcohol for themselves, and they take a little bit of the cut of the profits that the moonshiners end up with as well. So everybody gets along fine, not a big deal, until the big city, Chicago, legal types, Special Deputy, I think that was his name?
Special Deputy Marshall.
Yeah, played by Guy Pearce, comes in, and they want an even bigger cut of the profits, or they're going to shut everybody down. And that basically sets up your main conflict in the story. The sort of overarching character development centers on Shia LaBeouf as the youngest brother of the Bondurants, who is trying to be a tough guy, like his two older brothers, and has this sort of obsession with the gangster lifestyle. He kind of spotlights on Gary Oldman's character, who is a hardened Chicago gangster who happens to move into this area to sort of take over the unlawful side of the business. We can get more into him later. I don't want to say too much about his character right now. But yeah, the basic conflict is between the law and the lawless.
One of the things I loved about the posters is it's like. They also focused on heroism, and I'm like, heroism has nothing to do with this film. Not a single person in this film could be reasonably described as a hero.
Nope. No redeeming qualities.
But hey, Weinstein, go for it. I also like how on the final poster, all the names are written on Shia LaBeouf's vest. So his vest looks like he has the cast. He's like, I'm gonna go get some revenge, but
I really like
use Tom Hardy's cardigan.
Exactly. Oh, I love the cardigan. Brass knuckles in a cardigan. There are some really nice touches to this film.
Dude, I will tell you what. He, of all his characters, that's maybe the second one I would least like to meet in an alley. And Bane is not the first. Bronson is definitely the first. But then going to Forrest Bondurant, I definitely would not like to run up against this guy.
Well, I mean, but you'd have to piss him off. Like, he's not a bad guy.
No, he's not, but good God.
He is, and he's a guy that will destroy you. I think, to me, the interesting theme that revolves around the film is violence. You have one brother who wants to be a gangster without the violence, mm-hmm. and you have another one who, I don't know, you guys tell me. Do you think Forrest Bondurant is a violent person? Do you think, in the sense that, do you think he craves violence and he's trying to suppress it? Or do you think he's a guy that is good at violence and will resort to it, but he doesn't want to?
I think it's more the former, but he would like to think of himself as the latter. I think he's trying to suppress it and trying to lead a normal life, but I think when that switch flicks on, he really, really enjoys it.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it's a necessity for him, actually. He kind of seems like the middle ground between Jack and Howard. So Howard's played by Jason Clarke, who he has a scene where he's just kind of like this mad dog let off the leash. And that boy is just all about violence. And he just seems to love it and relish it and not really have control over it. Where Jack, played by Shia, is one that tends away from violence, but realizes that every once in a while, you're going to have to commit some violence to protect the things you love and get what you want out of life. And I think Forrest is kind of stuck somewhere in the middle. I believe he's the oldest brother, and he's kind of the patriarch at this point. And it seems like he's got sort of this philosophical side to him, which is kind of strange, because he'll go up to somebody, say this sort of philosophical rant, and then just punch you in the throat with brass knuckles. So it's kind of a weird dichotomy there. But I think it works for him. So I think violence for him is a necessity, and he has a nice couple of lines with his younger brother Jack, where he talks about the necessity of violence, and it's all about how far you're willing to go, not about the violence itself.
That's what Forrest Bondurant says. It's not even about whether you will do it. It's sort of to quote another violent series. Or not a series. To quote Breaking Bad, no half measures.
True.
The thing first. Oh, I just to give this time, just a little side note. I loved Tom Hardy's performance because of the. I mean, it's a great performance, but just the muttering. It's one of those performances you walk out and you're doing an impression of it. Just,
yes.
Oh, yeah. Oh, right. Okay.
What are you doing?
Like when he basically Jessica Chastain plays mm-hmm. this woman from Chicago who kind of wants a quiet life, and the Bondurants have kind of a filling station that's also kind of a bar, and she comes to be the help there, and she shows up in this amazing dress and kind of she's like, so do I get the job? And Hardy says, because this the most non-committal yet agree, he's like, you get it, but he's just like he doesn't
walks out.
It's just like he mutters and walks out. That has to be one of my favorite movie moments of the year. And I to call attention to the other performances, I think Shia LaBeouf is great.
Yeah.
And the two that kind of feel a little off is, I think, Guy Pearce, who is a great actor and is having an interesting 2012 because of being coated in makeup in Prometheus and just being Snake Plissken in Lockout, which he was great in. Lockout works because of him.
Right.
But here he's just so over the top. It doesn't really fit with the rest of the movie. The rest of the movie feels very lived in and not historical document, but very low key. And then you have this guy with no eyebrows, this slick back black hair that's, I think, with shoe shine or some kind of weird ass dye. And
Dapper Dan.
It's Dapper Dan.
He's not a Dapper Dan man.
Not Fop. And he's got this high pitched voice, and he's wearing gloves, and he seems to be very tidy. It's just almost, it's just too much. It was too much for me. What about you guys?
I agree. It was sort of like he's not supposed to fit in. At some point, like, somebody calls him a Nancy, and he kind of takes very much offense to that. I get it when you're trying to put him there as this other, you know, this guy who has got these, like, very expensive suits, and they're very immaculate, and he's incredibly clean to the point of just, like, you know, discarding anything that gets somewhat dirty. But I agree with you. It's way too over the top. I mean, you bring in Gary Oldman's character, who's supposed to be this gangster out of Chicago.
And that was the other one. That's so weird. Like, Gary Oldman is in a nothing role. It's distracting because you think he's going to be bigger.
You expect him to carry throughout the entire film, and he doesn't. But having said that, his character, at least the way he's portrayed, he fits in to the world way more than Pierce does, I think.
Yeah.
Just with his mannerisms. And, yeah.
Well, I disagree. I didn't feel like he was, I mean, he obviously he was over the top, but it worked for me in that he wasn't, it explained why he was so, like, he's crazy. He mm-hmm. obviously he has issues. Stuff has happened to him in the past.
That is the nicest way to put it. Obviously he has issues.
Well, he's not a normal person, which explains, yeah. I mean, if you just had a normal person doing all the things that he does in this movie, it makes no sense. Like, why is he this hellbent? Why is he so angry? And why does he want to kill them? Like, what is his problem? I mean, they're not paying him money. Okay, like, if you had Gary Oldman's character do it, it would just, you know, Gary Oldman wouldn't be as hardcore about it. He would, you know, send some of his thugs to go and rough him up. But Guy Pierce is he's almost like a snake. He's really, really just off-putting and slimy. And it worked for me because that explained away why, especially in the film's finale, why he does the things that he does and why he acts the way he does.
I think one of my issues with the film was there was, and I don't like to get into a lot of exposition and backstory, but a little bit more I think could have helped. So I don't know if there's some left on the cutting room floor, but like there was nothing really about Pierce's character, Charlie Rakes. There was nothing about the Bondurants really. I mean, why is Tom Hardy's character, there's a scene where Jessica Chastain is basically like seducing him and he's literally just sitting in there bundled up in his bed and he's like, "Oh, what are you doing?" And everybody in the theater starts laughing. It's like, what has happened in his sort of past to make him maybe not celibate, but kind of just like very focused on his business and sort of family oriented, but kind of cold at the same time.
That's one of those things I don't need an explanation for. There's
like, I would have liked a little bit more because it's like just give me one incident, you know, give me something to kind of anchor me to his character
a
little bit.
I see him as so tightly wound mm-hmm. that anything resembling love or passion that isn't violent. I can see why he would retreat from that. Again, that's one of those things where the performance really delivers a lot, says a lot without saying anything.
Sure.
Yeah, it's all said in his face.
Exactly. It's one of those things where I felt it wasn't a need for backstory. I think I need to revisit The Proposition, but looking at The Road and Lawless, I think the overlap is John Hillcoat makes these films where he wants for things to feel gritty and real, which is fine, except he gets unintentionally loud. Because, yeah, The Road doesn't have any particularly loud moments, mm-hmm. but because it is so unrelentingly bleak, that's all you can focus on. There are these distractions, these unintentional distractions, almost to the point where it's like you've done your job too well.
Mm-hmm.
So The Road, yeah, it should be bleak, but not to the point where I can't even focus on anything else, where I just, my goal in life now is for the film to be over so I can get out of the theater and remember that life still exists. And this one, yeah, there's a compelling antagonist in the sense of he's memorable,
mm-hmm.
but that's not the point. That's not the essential good. I think there's a notion where it's like, oh, yeah, it should be memorable. I mean, why wouldn't you want characters to be memorable? But they can overshadow. And I think that's the problem with Guy Pierce's character.
I feel like a lot of that is on Guy Pierce because I feel like in, you know, on the page, that was probably just more of a straightforward.
No, that's on both of them. They've worked together in all three films. And
well, I'm saying that he probably came to John Hillcoat and said, I want to flesh this out. I want to make, like, let's work together to, you know, really create a character here.
Yeah, and John, I mean, yeah, sure, that's on Pierce as well, but John Hillcoat has to share some of the blame there.
I'm not saying Guy Pierce is
not a guy who comes in and just starts pushing the director around, especially not one where they've worked together before.
No, I'm just saying I don't feel like that was the exact character that was written on the page.
And I, after the screening here in Atlanta, Matt Bondurant, who's the author, and the story is based off his family history, he was talking about how the real Charlie Riggs was nothing like that. But
sure.
So there was not a flamboyant character, and actually the guy started off as a pretty reasonable guy, and yes, he did take more of an active role, but he was never as flamboyant as the one in the film. So again, this is something done to color this world, and I think it's just it's too much.
And that's why I liked Gary Oldman's portrayal of it. I just, like we said, I wish he was kind of in the film, or at least integral a little bit more. It's kind of like one of those things, like, you either have him in there or you don't. I mean, I understand that so his basic use in the film was to sort of catapult the family through Jack's actions into a higher level of wealth, into the next level of business. It's pretty much all he was there for.
And that's really just as part of Jack's story. I mean, Jack and Forrest, their plots are intertwined, but Gary Oldman never really seems to affect Forrest Bondurant's life.
No, there's a secondhand kind of passing in the night kind of between those two.
Waiting for the other shoe to drop. You're like, right. Well, when does Gary Oldman come back? Like, when? Obviously, this had something more to do with it, but no.
Yeah, and they drop it. I mean, it's just dropped completely. The end seemed a little rushed to me. The last act seemed a little rushed and a little... the payoff wasn't quite as great as I was expecting. It just kind of ended. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I felt like the whole movie didn't really... It was like listening to Matt Bondurant's story of his family. Like, this is how it happened. It's not really reaching for any greater themes to me. And that's why I don't think it would have been a good awards contender. It doesn't really go to that next level.
I would disagree with that. I think it does have some... I think it has some deeper themes, like I said, regarding violence.
Well, violence and family, Jack. I think, too. The interplay of the family is interesting. The focusing on Jack and trying to see him sort of become a man, sort of the coming-of-age thing for him, is great. I just don't think it doesn't overreach. I'm not saying this as a knock on the film. I'm just saying it doesn't overreach. It stays very contained and very solid. And I think it does what it was set out to do.
Okay. Well, to get hung up on Guy Pearce, because I want to say that the setting is amazing. Mm-hmm. And let's get hung up on Guy Pearce, because he distracts from the amazing setting. I loved the look of sort of Prohibition era in the South, and mm-hmm. that will be my segue into this week's recommendations, unless anyone has anything else to say about Lawless. Nope. We're good?
we're
all
good.
Out of Lawless?
I will say this. Okay. I will say this. The violence, since Matt made that kind of his central theme, good Lord, some of the violence is brutal. Absolutely.
Yeah.
If you haven't seen this film yet, my God, they really take it to a next level. Now, I have a thing. I've sat through horror movies and fights and all kinds of stuff. I've seen pretty much everything out there. I have a personal issue with, like, throat-cutting scenes, and holy crap. I thank God I was sitting down for this movie, because I had a real tough time with a particular scene in this film. So it is very brutal. If you have any bit of a weak stomach, then it's going to be a tough ride for you. But brutal violence in this film, and everybody gets a share.
Well, I feel like that's where Hillcoat shines, in that this isn't, I mean, you see the trailers and, you know, people are probably like, oh yeah, man, shoot 'em up movie, like Boondock Saints. And then you go and it's this very, I mean, the crux of the story for me was the relationship between Forrest and Jack. And Jack, mm-hmm. you know, sees Gary Oldman with the Tommy gun and is like, oh, I want to do that. I want to, like, violence is cool. I want to be a gangster. But then Hillcoat deals with the violence in such a raw, realistic, mm-hmm. and brutal way that it shocks the audience. It's not like, oh, that was really cool. It's like, holy shit.
Yeah,
like, that's not fun.
Had a tough time. I was like, please just move to the next scene. It's like, everything else I'm fine with, but please just get off this scene, man.
Right.
So it's visceral. It definitely is at times.
Well, moving on to a more lighthearted Prohibition era, or not really Prohibition, I'm sorry. This takes a little bit later, but we're going to go to the Old South, and not too Old South. Let's say Medium South, post-slavery South, early 20th century South. No, God damn it! I was about to get Prohibition era South confused with Depression era South. And Depression Era South is my week's recommendation for Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Mm.
And the reason I bring it up, and it's not that it's a really old film, but I feel like it's a little bit overlooked in the Coen Brothers filmography. Not that people don't know it or that it's a bad film. I think it's great. It's loosely based on the Odyssey, but it takes place in the Depression Era South. George Clooney plays a criminal who escapes from a chain gang with two other guys played by Tim Blake Nelson and John Turturro to seek a treasure of money that's been buried beneath a cabin, and the cabin is about to be destroyed for hydroelectric they're going to blow up a dam to make way for hydroelectric power, so the house where the money's buried is about to be washed away and the money lost along with it. So they're on their way to get the money, but George Clooney's character has an ulterior motive. He wants to get back with his ex-wife, played by Holly Hunter, before she marries a new guy. And she has told his children that he was hit by a train. It's really funny, but the reason I think it gets a little overlooked is because it has an amazing, amazing soundtrack, just this phenomenal bluegrass soundtrack, and I think that gets all the attention, and it should. It should get some attention, but I think the film is hilarious. It is... So there's a scene that I really love where John Turturro has been captured by a chain gang, or not by a chain gang, but he's been recaptured, and Tim Blake Nelson and George Clooney are still, they're kind of hiding out, and because it ties into the Odyssey, they think that John Turturro has been turned into a toad by sirens. Like, there are these women at a... There are these three women at a stream who are cleaning their clothes, and they're singing, and they're sort of romance them, and they give them moonshine, tied it back to Lawless. And they pass out, and when they wake up, John Turturro's gone, and that's because he's been arrested. He wandered off and was arrested, but when they wake up, they just see a toad. And they pick him up, and they turn to... Then they go see a movie. They're hiding out in a movie theater, and then naturally the new chain gang that John Turturro is on comes in, and John Turturro looks at them because he knows that they'll, you know, he ratted them out, but not to where they were, just to where they were going. And so he tells them, "Do not seek the treasure." And Tim Blake Nelson whispers back, "We thought you was a toad." John Turturro just pauses for a second, looks at them and goes, "Do not seek the treasure." It's just filled with those weird moments. And I think another reason it gets a little ignored is because there was this period between Big Lebowski. It was the first film that came after Big Lebowski. But I think there's this period in the Coen's filmography between Lebowski and No Country for Old Men that gets a little forgotten. Like, I don't think a lot of people talk about The Man Who Wasn't There, which I think is also a really terrific film. And then there's...
Or Cruelty.
Intolerable Cruelty is not a good movie, and I'm the only guy in the world who likes The Lady Killers. So those two films, I think, kind of suck in Man Who Wasn't There and Oh Brother into the, sort of this black hole. But it's a film that if you're a Coen Brothers fan, revisit it. You probably haven't seen it in a while, and not to presume about your viewing habits, but it's a really enjoyable film. It's so funny, so well acted, and... Again, the soundtrack is phenomenal. So my recommendation this week is Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Dave, what do you have for us?
I'm going to stick with themes of family and specifically sort of brotherhood and the ties between brothers, as well as tying in the theme of violence. And I'm actually going to go with 1999 Troy Duffy cult classic, The Boondock Saints.
No. I'm sorry.
Did Adam not know that?
I knew that. And I just, please tell me why you like The Boondock Saints. I know we're not supposed to trash each other's recommendations, but I'm sorry. I can't help it. I can't help it. It's The Boondock
Saints. I thought I was like,
hated that movie.
What?
I thought I was the only person who hated that
no,
movie.
No. I hate it. My friend Carl hates it.
Oh, how do you guys hate
because
this movie?
It's
Are
like,
you kidding me?
It's just, it's such a painful ripoff of, it's trying so hard to be Tarantino, and it's so meaningless and poorly made. Oh, God, it's trying so hard, and yet it's so unrelentingly
Holy
stupid.
Holy crap, now that I know how you feel, I don't care. I'm still going to recommend
it. No, recommend it. Tell me why you like it. I don't want to shut you down. Tell me why you like
The
Boondock.
Oh, there's no way you're shutting me down.
No,
anyway,
tell me why you like The Boondock Saints.
And Norman Reedus, who you guys probably know from The Walking Dead, if you're not familiar with Boondock Saints, as two sort of the Irish Catholic brothers who kind of take upon themselves this vendetta to sort of clean up their streets, and they start taking out gang members and just sort of all manner of low-level scum and villainy. And they definitely do it in a much more lighthearted way than something like Lawless. It's very tongue-in-cheek. The other interesting...
Except they have a really cool prayer that they just made up for when they assassinate
absolutely,
people. Because that would be cool, wouldn't it?
It would be cool, and it is cool.
No, it isn't.
Don't listen to Goldberg, kids.
Go on.
Make sure you say your prayers before you take out scum
your made-up prayer. Not even...
Make up a prayer.
Make up a prayer.
And so the other interesting
Ezekiel
thing that 23. I thought...
I'm sorry, go on.
You and your Bible studies.
No, that's me other interesting... saying he ripped off Pulp Fiction.
You can't rip off Pulp Fiction. I've yet to see any kind of rip off of Pulp Fiction, but this is a discussion for another day. So another interesting parallel from Lawless to this, since we talked about Guy Pearce's character being completely insane and over the top, Willem Dafoe comes in as this detective to help sort of with the casework of the local criminals. And he's sort of this very intuitive but also very insane detective who just kind of deteriorates over the course of the film, just becomes crazier and crazier to the point of being a cross-dressing prostitute in one of the most insane scenes I think I've ever seen him in. So completely crazy. Again, much more lighthearted than something like Lawless. Nothing to really take seriously. This is not one of those films that I like hold as gospel. It's just, to me, a very entertaining film, an interesting premise of these two brothers that are kind of like untouchable, and they're going out and they're sort of laying down their own particular brand of falsely religious justice. And there's a good twist at the end that involves another one of their family members. I will say, do not see the sequel to this. Just stick with the Boondock Saints by itself and don't listen to Matt or Adam, because Boondock Saints is definitely a cult classic.
The two characters speak multiple languages, because that's awesome, even though it's completely unbelievable that they would be fluent in multiple languages.
Why is it necessarily unbelievable? Just because they're two Irish Catholic boys that work in a meatpacking plant.
You're right.
Nothing in
totally buy it
South
now.
Boston somewhere.
They probably picked it up. In their studies,
just
when they were busy making
lines
up
that
prayers.
They say in the film. That's all they know how to say.
Next week on The Collision, we'll just be ragging on the Boondock Saints for a solid hour.
Devote the whole podcast.
Let's do that. Adam, what do you got for us?
In
Boondock Saints 2.
Well, in keeping with the theme of recommending movies Matt does not like, I am recommending John Hillcoat's The Road.
So bleak.
It is bleak. It's very bleak, but it's – okay, for those who don't know, it came out in 2009. It didn't make very much money. I don't think many people
Why?
Saw it.
Why would it not make much money, Adam? It's such a crowd pleaser. It came out at Thanksgiving.
Well, what did you expect? It's based on a book by Cormac McCarthy. It takes place in a post-apocalyptic wasteland, and it stars Viggo Mortensen and Cody Smith-McPhee as a father and son duo. And they've been kind of living for a while. We have flashbacks throughout the movie of Cody Smith-McPhee's mother, played by Charlize Theron, who gives birth to him after whatever event that changed the world happened. That's never explained. It's not particularly of any importance. What the movie's really about is it's about humanity and how far you will go to keep your loved ones safe, or, you know, the just kind of the dissolution of what it means to be a human being. Everything that we think, you know, being altruistic, you know, you think that you'd act a certain way in a condition like this, but you see this movie and you think like, oh man, like it would be really, really bad. This is exactly kind of what happened. So it kind of forces you to reexamine, you know, humanity and our connection with other human beings and strangers. I mean, there's cannibalism in this movie. It's, as Matt said, it's incredibly bleak. It's not a happy movie, but I feel like it's an important movie to see. I feel like it kind of touches on some issues that people, I mean, I certainly hadn't thought about it much, but when I saw this movie, it kind of forced me to go into a deep depression and stay in a dark room for days and days. No, it just kind of forced me to kind of, you know, you think about things a little differently. It's got some great performances by Viggo Mortensen. I mean, and again, there are really no heroic characters in this movie. It also kind of touches on the innocence of childhood and Cody Smith-McPhee's view of this world. He was never alive before any of this happened. There's no electricity. He doesn't know. There's a really, really nice scene where he has Coca-Cola in the movie. He's never had a soft drink in his entire life. And it's really kind of sweet and sad and, you know, also bleak. But it's John Hillcoat, 2009. You should watch it. Plan on not having a happy mood after you see the movie. But
really, I was actually really overjoyed when the road was over, because it's like, oh, my God, sunlight. I was so happy after the road was over.
I didn't feel like the bleakness. When I was watching this movie, I wasn't. I mean, yes, I was thinking, "Wow, this is really bleak," but I wasn't thinking, "I need this to be over. I don't want to watch this anymore."
It's not that I didn't want to stop watching. I don't want to say like, "Oh, it wasn't compelling." I was just, when I got out, like I felt like it was sunny outside, and I just like, it's gonna be okay. Thank goodness I'm not in that world anymore. So,
but that's effective filmmaking.
It is effective filmmaking. But for me, it was also one note filmmaking.
All right.
All right, so now that I've ragged on both your choices.
Add that to your list of things that Matt Goldberg hates.
Yep, that's all I do. I want to say this, though. This is our 18th episode, and up until now, I think you guys have given great recommendations. I haven't argued with a single recommendation because I think they've all been great. Up until now. I think there's been – you guys have been, what, 17? That's what?
I don't even know. Some kind
Help me with math. Help me with math. You guys have been 34 for 34. So it's just, you know, it's an off week. It's an off week where I am the only one who had a good recommendation. And, you know, it happens, guys. It happens.
Screw you, Bill.
Oh, God.
I'm sending the McManus boys over to your house after this.
No. You like the Lady Killers, so shut up.
I do. That is true. If I'd recommend the Lady Killers, you'd be like, fuck you in the face. All right, so next week we won't be here. I will be at Toronto. So we won't be recording. We will be back the following.
Are you sure?
That I'm going to the Toronto Film Festival?
No, the week after that. Well, we can talk about it later.
We're not going to be there the week after? Yeah, we might not be here. We might be on a brief, 3-week hiatus, because of scheduling conflicts. And not Sunday, but the Sunday after, it would probably just be me rambling. And I could do that hour-long show about why the Boondock Saint sucks. I could do it, guys, but I won't. So, Collision listeners, if you're still with us, God damn it. Anyone who makes it to the end of the show, God bless you. If you're still listening, we will probably be taking a 3-week hiatus, but please come back. We'll have plenty to talk about when we return. If you want to follow this podcast, you can follow us on Twitter. You can follow me on Twitter at Matt Goldberg. Adam?
At Adam Chitwood.
And Dave?
At Dr. Claw MD.
All right. Thank you all for listening, and we'll be back 3 weeks from now.